from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We have a busy show ahead of us tonight. You'll know my next two guests, the authors of the book, A Question of Murder, Donna Kaufman, and famed forensic pathologist, Dr. Cyril Weck. We're here tonight to talk about Dr. Anna Marie Poe, who we all know was part of the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina and the euthanization of patients in the nursing home. We remember the story. It was talked about in the book by our next two authors, and there's a sad twist to the story, and I thought I'd bring them on tonight to talk about it. Dr. Weck, Donna, how are you?
Good evening. How are you?
Yes, hi.
Doing fine. Dr. Weck, we'll start with you. If you could, this goes back actually probably 4 years now, refresh my audience's memory a little bit about this Dr. Poe, or if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, well, my involvement started when I was contacted by the Attorney General of the state of Louisiana to review the deaths of people who had died suddenly, inexplicably, and rather amazingly, all within about a period of three and a half hours on Thursday morning. I believe it was September 1st, and Hurricane Katrina having hit sometime after midnight Sunday into Monday morning of that week. And these people now were scheduled to be evacuated. There were helicopters, there were boats, there were able-bodied people around. Everything was in place. And while it was a tough situation, admittedly, it wasn't quite as bad, perhaps, as it has been made out to be, and Donna can give you more details on that. In any event, I reviewed the autopsies and the toxicological analyses, and it was very clear that these people had all been euthanized. The levels of drugs, most of them involved morphine. Some involved the midazolam Versed, one of the drugs, by the way, which has come to light with Michael Jackson, and some other drugs, all of which were central nervous system depressants, all of which are designed to alleviate depression, allay anxiety, ameliorate pain, and so on. And one or two of the drugs were appropriate, but other drugs were not. Morphine is not a drug that you would give under those circumstances. In any event, even without getting into that discussion, the point is that the levels were so substantial. There is absolutely no question that they were far, far beyond what anybody might have reasonably given for purposes of something other than killing those people. So I submitted my results to the Attorney General. He had good people working on it, forensic nurses. Subsequently, there was a meeting at the coroner's office in New Orleans with the coroner of Orleans Parish, Dr. Frank Minyard, a forensic pathology colleague, Dr. Michael Bodden, was there, and the toxicologist who had performed the test for National Medical Services, Dr. Rob Middleberg, an outstanding forensic toxicologist. So the three of us reviewed all those cases, plus many more. And we all agreed, it was unanimity of opinion, unequivocally, unquestionably. And then subsequently, we had other people look at it. Dr. Minyard wanted to make sure, a top guy from North Carolina, and Dr. James Young, who was in Canada, former president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, a top-level guy, and everybody agreed. Well, amazingly, this is where it all then fell apart, and none of this was presented to the grand jury. So just one case was described, I'm told, I wasn't there. Not one of the experts was ever called, nor was it recommended that we be called. Regrettably, the district attorney of New Orleans took over the case, which he has the power to do. Louisiana law is different from other states. It's the actual reverse of what exists in other states. And he took the case away from the attorney general. First, he thought it would be a great vehicle for him to ride into the mayor's office or some higher office. And then when the public relations machine got cranked up by the local medical society and various other groups and individuals, trying to promote Dr. Poe's complete innocence, in fact, making her out to be a great heroine and so on, when the fire got hot, then the district attorney just backed off completely. Donna can fill you in on so much more. Donna, please.
Donna, you know, as a crime author, you see stories like this. Of course, you've written about it already in your book. You and Dr. Wecht have authored A Question of Murder. I'm going to use the term playing God. Is that what this doctor did?
Well, yes. In fact, she has admitted doing that. And she was a rather famous cancer surgeon specializing in ear, nose, and throat surgeries. And she was well-known in that community, and she had a lot of trust of the people in that hospital. And during the time that Memorial Medical Center was being housed, it was housing something like 2,000 people during the worst of Katrina, and soon it lost electricity and running water, but there was food and there was water, sparkling water, and it was not a pleasant place at all, but it was better than outside where there was gunfire and all sorts of, you know, terrible conditions outside. So there was an evacuation for days, and as Dr. Wex said, with boats and with helicopters. And they got the population down from 2,000 to just a couple hundred remaining people. And the worst of the patients were on the seventh floor, and they were viable. They were not dying necessarily. They were people who should have been evacuated, who could have been evacuated. Other people on that floor were, and at a certain point, it was just decided, let's just get out of town, and, let's just not leave anyone alive here. And whether that came from Tenet Healthcare, who owned the hospital, or whether that was Dr. Poe's own decision, that's something that the reader will have to decide. But that is what happened, and there are witnesses, including some that I spoke to, who saw her go from patient to patient with a handful of syringes and say, this is going to help you relax. And those people were then left to die. And by the way, medicines that they were injected with were not necessarily part of their normal regimen of treatment. So that is, here's the irony. They didn't expect that anyone was going to be able to get into the hospital in time to find that the corpses were able to be tested for toxicology. In other words, a couple of weeks, a month or something like that, there wouldn't have been anything left of the people to test. But rescuers were able to get to those bodies within days, and that is why Dr. West was able to do the treatment, to do the testing, toxicological testing. So the terrible thing is that after it was found that these people were murdered, Dr. Poe get a publicist and went on 60 Minutes and then gave a Newsweek thing interview and recently just did the New York Times and has been very good about being a spin doctor. And she now is giving lectures about emergency medicine and what to do in crises. So she's very adept at making herself look like a hero. But the numbers are the numbers. The facts are the facts. And the reports that Dr. Wecht and his team did were never given to the grand jury.
And that's unfortunate. We'll get into that in a little bit. Dr. Wecht, for my listeners, most, you know, they'll understand a little bit about sedation. You know, you're in the hospital and you need to be sedated to be calmed down. But let's talk about, you know, euthanization of a human being and what it takes and what actually happens to that person who is viable. One was a 380-pound man, must have taken a lot of drugs to put him down because of his size, but I'm just guessing at that. Let's just talk about what happens to the human body.
Well, yes, it takes a lot of drugs, you're quite right, to put someone down like that. And that's why the quantities that were found are so significant and so relevant from a medical legal standpoint. If this were a close call, then Don and I would not be here talking to you. We would not have written about this. We would not have laid out the findings. In our book, Question of Murder, these specific amounts are spelled out. You don't have to be a toxicologist to understand that, because we explain what the levels are. And to my knowledge, as we speak here, even this late date, nowhere else will you find publicly disclosed the levels of the different drugs that were found in these people who were euthanized by Dr. Poe that morning at Memorial Hospital. And, you know, it's just really, it's there. And there is nothing of an equivocal nature about this. I cannot emphasize that enough. I've been doing medical legal consultations for 47 years, and I understand there can be differences of opinion, and I make that clear. I don't like to come on and go too far overboard or say something that because I believe it, that it leaves no room for other opinions. I want to make this clear. This is not something that is subjective. This is as objective as you can possibly get. The levels are off the chart. You could divide those amounts and kill two or three or more people, let alone one. And what is despicable, reprehensible, immoral, unethical, and outright illegal is that all of this is being covered up by all of the government officials, the district attorney, the new attorney general, not the one that was originally involved, the new attorney general, all other government agencies. The feds have not moved in on this, and they should too. There are many ways in which the feds could become involved if they wanted to. As we all know, there are many doors through which the feds can walk in, sometimes quite unfairly, unreasonably, and with political malevolence. But there are other times when they can move in legitimately, and this would be one. And then, of course, the medical society, they've all banded together. And like Donna said, Poe, she's out there now. She's fantastic. She should get a job in Hollywood or with a public relations firm on Madison Avenue, which she has sold special legislation to protect other doctors in similar situations in the future and so on. They've stopped just short of getting her to be nominated for the civilian equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor.
You know, it's just disgusting to hear this story. Donna, Poe was actually arrested, was she not? Being arrested for one thing and actually facing charges is another thing.
Yes, she was arrested, and as were two nurses that she was with that morning. And the, eventually the nurses were let go and told her that they, if they testified against her, which they agreed to do. And so she was in custody only a few hours. And but, you know, there was no trial. You know, it never went to trial because the grand jury...
Well, it never got past grand jury.
Right.
Right. The grand jury refused to indict because they did not have all the information in front of them. You can't expect a grand jury to make a wise decision if they don't have the tools to work with.
You know, we hear, sorry to interrupt, Donna, but we hear so much about Michael Jackson and this Dr. Conrad Murray and propofol and all this sort of stuff. Anna Nicole Smith, who, of course, you talk about in your book, and the enabling and the drug issues there. Is this a case that it's not becoming part of the mainstream media? It's not becoming part of the judiciary as far as charges being laid because there isn't anyone famous involved? You hate to say that, but is that possible, Dr. Wecht?
I can, by the way, can you, if you all could speak up a little bit, I don't know, something wrong with my phone, but I'm getting very faint. If I heard you correctly, you talk about criminal charges. Sure, just as there have been, well, it's not quite directly analogous. Similarities have to do with the availability and the administration of drugs in the Anna Nicole Smith, for which Howard G. Stern, her attorney and confidant and close friend, and two doctors, Kapoor and Irasevich, are facing criminal charges. They've been indicted, and I think the trial is supposed to start next month in October. It had been postponed. And Michael Jackson case, you can be sure that within a matter of some weeks ahead, they'll be bringing charges against Dr. Conrad Murray and other physicians, too, who and pharmacists who got the drugs, prescribed them knowingly, and so on. Well, this is a somewhat different situation, but the point is, and the things that are similar are that somebody used drugs improperly, excessively, inappropriately, unnecessarily, and that death ensued. And therein lies the ingredients. I'm not saying that these are first-degree murder charges. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But there's no question, at the very least, they would be cases involving voluntary manslaughter.
Donna, again, my comparison was not that it's similar to Jackson, but again, with a celebrity, with drugs being used, a doctor being involved, we seem to hear a lot about Jackson, but we hear very little about that case besides what you and the good doctor have brought forward. Your thoughts on the coverage of both stories, Donna Kaufman?
Well, you know, it's to the shame of the good people of New Orleans that they have not pursued this case.
Right.
Or want to hear about it. That's the thing. It's very possible that with her ability to persuade people about what great decision she made that day, that she could have been tried and acquitted because New Orleans does not want to prosecute this doctor. The people don't want to either. If you read in the newspapers, there's a great swell of public opinion in her corner, but that's because they don't know the facts of the case. So, I think she has a local celebrity that is working in her favor. But like Dr. Wecht said, ours is the only book that tells the facts that have been laid out so clearly here. And we're just hopeful that people will become more educated. Because if it happened there, it can happen in any hospital. This is something that managed care and anyone who has a relative or loved one in a hospital or long-term facility should know has potential to happen.
Absolutely. The book is A Question of Murder. The author is Donna Kaufman, Dr. Cyril Wecht. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Hey, Dana, we always love being with you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that's Donna Kaufman, Dr. Cyril Wecht. Again, pick up the book. It's called A Question of Murder, and you'll be able to read more about this Dr. Poe. We're going to be back in a minute with attorney Joel Brodsky. You'll know Joel Brodsky is Drew Peterson's attorney, and get an update as far as what's happening with this case. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. You'll know my next guest. He was quite a regular on the program here for a while. He and his client, Drew Peterson, probably one of the more high-profile cases in North America right now. You know, Drew Peterson, the former Bolingbrook police sergeant, currently in custody and awaiting trial. Joel Brodsky is here. Hi, Joel.
Hi. Hi, Dana. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing? I understand you got the flu.
Yeah, I got a little bit of a cold here. Oh, but, get over it.
That's not good. I don't imagine you've been getting much rest with your client. And
yeah, well, we've been plowing through the discoveries, the 40,000 pages of documents and another probably 20,000 pages in grand jury transcripts. So that's kept us occupied, that's for sure.
40,000, did I hear you right?
40,000 in police reports and documents and about 20,000 in grand jury transcripts.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, we got some help, though. We were able to get a number of law students to assist us in going through everything. So it's not overwhelming because probably out of all that, maybe 10% of that's really relevant. But, you know, you got to dig out the diamonds out of the rest. So.
For sure. Last we heard, as far as media coverage on your client, or the big media coverage on your client, it was the change of venue and the challenge on the what we'll call the hearsay law. Let's start with change of venue first. What's going on there?
Well, the judges set the rule on October 2nd on whether or not this change of venue has two parts of it. One is presumptive, and then the other is the ability that you act what they call actual prejudice and substantive prejudice, or presumed prejudice. So the judge is going to rule on the first part of it, which is presumed prejudice, on October 2nd. And that has to do with the judge saying that, look, there's been just way too much publicity here in Will County and Northern Illinois, and that because of that, there, no matter what, there's just no way we can pick a fair jury, so I'm going to send it to another county. Then, even if he doesn't find presumed prejudice, when we actually sit down and start trying to pick a jury, if it turns out that we're really, you know, spending days and weeks trying to pick a jury and we can't do it, then he still could find actual prejudice, and we could still end up getting a change of venue. Just we won't know that till the actual trial starts.
So that's
where we are with that.
Okay, as far as the hearsay law, a little bit more complicated, and we'll have to cover that in a little bit more in depth. What's that all about when we hear about hearsay law?
Yeah, in fact, we just received the state's reply briefs yesterday, so we're starting to work on our responses. What we're saying is there's a law in Illinois that was recently passed, and it's kind of referred to as the Drew Peterson Law, and by the state's attorney's own admission, he said that it was in response to the Drew Peterson case and another case up here in Northern Illinois called Stebbik, and he got drafted this law in response to these cases, and it basically lets in a lot of hearsay. What they're trying to do is basically say if somebody kills the spouse in order to prevent a spouse from testifying in a divorce case or a domestic violence case, that the hearsay that spouse had said at any time to anybody would come into evidence at the murder trial. So, it's a very broad brush when it comes to hearsay exceptions. And it also, I think, allows, it is the first time I've ever found a case that allows, actions in a civil case. You know, testimony would come into a civil case to be introduced in a criminal case. So, I know it's like you said, it's very complex, but, and basically, it's going to allow But spouses that are in contentious hearings, divorce cases, order protection cases, you know, hearsay to their friends and relatives about those cases to come into a murder trial, which I think is just reprehensible. I really have a hard time with that.
You know, when you look at it without getting into the direct facts of Drew's case, unless you want to, I'll use two examples. A deceased spouse who wrote letters, if I die, so-and-so did it. That's one. The other example would be my husband told me and me tells someone else. Not me comes forward, but the someone else comes forward and says that I heard from so-and-so that so-and-so told her. The question in law, no matter where you are, is where does it stop? First, second, third person hearsay, a note on a wall, a carving on a tree. I'm not making light of it, but there has to be some ground rules.
Well, the ground rules, I think, are what the Supreme Court said in Crawford and in Giles. And what they're saying is the greatest engine of truth that we have is a well-done cross-examination by a competent lawyer. If you have you're trying to prove a fact or prove testimony, and you come up against a well-prepared and competent attorney in cross-examination, and you survive that, then you know the fact is proven. that's our test. That's been the law since before this nation was founded. Cross-examination is sacrosanct. But these new laws, what the Supreme Court said in Crawford, in the Crawford case, and what now the Illinois statute is trying to do away with, is trying to do away with their right to cross-examine and confront witnesses. And, you know, in Illinois, I have a real problem with this. We had 13 people on death row in this state who were exonerated. In fact, we have other people in the newspaper today here in Chicago. I was reading about a man who was in jail 23 years for a rape he didn't commit that was exonerated because of, thank God, because of DNA. And in each of these cases, you had testimony that these people were doing it. You know, somebody stood up on the stand and said, he raped me, or, you know, somebody stood up on the stand and said, I saw him shoot so-and-so. And it turns out they were incorrect. Now what we've done is even in the face of all these wrongful convictions, the state is trying to loosen the rules of evidence to get what has got to be the most, the deepest pool of evidence of gossip and hearsay, you know, marital strife, and let that into evidence in a murder case. And I think that, you know, what we're doing is we're heading in the wrong direction. And these wrongful convictions should have taught us to really take people's statements with a jaundiced eye and to really rely upon forensics and hard evidence. Not so-and-so said to so-and-so in the middle of a divorce that my husband, you know, wants me dead.
Yeah.
That's not evidence. It simply is just gossip, and that shit has no place in the courtroom.
Well, my personal opinion is, and I've covered a case where a little, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, Joel, where a little 11-year-old girl is on her way to actually testify at a preliminary hearing. She had been allegedly raped and sodomized by her stepfather. She's killed in a car accident. The evidence is the little girl. And when it came to the argument of the defense, of course, they used Crawford versus Washington and said that any statement that the little girl made, including to police officers, including to hospital workers, doctors, social service workers, etc., were to be excluded. That's the big argument. Now, I think there's a difference in a case like that, where that, along with any other forensics or any other physical evidence, can be tied together, then if my husband my husband said he would kill me in a transcript from a divorce hearing, there's got to be a fair line drawn down the middle, or am I wrong?
Well, you know, to draw that line is the problem, because the line always gets pushed. You know, the story you say about the little 11-year-old girl. For example, even under Crawford v. Washington and Giles versus California, the new case that was just about a year old by the Supreme Court, statements to doctors would be admissible. So if this little girl had told doctors in trying to get treatment that she had been raped by her stepfather, that would be admissible. It doesn't take out all hearsay. There are some very well-established, long-time exceptions to the hearsay rule and the confrontation clause that come in. But I think when it comes to this type of hearsay, hearsay where you have, you're basically taking civil cases and people who are in highly emotional states, and what do they say is a fine line between love and hate, and
right.
These people who were one time in love and now are in a great deal of hate are just saying horrible things about each other during the middle of divorce cases, and then something happens, somebody's killed, we had an accident, a suicide, or there's a murder, but we don't, but there's no forensic evidence tying anybody to that murder. Then to have this type of gossip statement come into a court of law parading as real evidence, it's just reprehensible, and I just don't think we should be allowed in. I think what you're going to end up having is a lot of wrongful convictions, and eventually there's going to be another bunch of wrongful of exonerations down the line as people come forward and start saying, I was really mad at him, or but I really didn't say that, or yeah. I really didn't hear that, but I was just mad at the time, and that's the problem. Who knows why people will say things when they do, especially in emotional situations. People lie enough and when they're not in emotional situations. So I just don't think their line should be drawn anywhere. The right of cross-examination of occurrence witnesses is something that we have to, our Constitution says, has to be held holy, so to speak.
Joel Brodsky's here. Of course, Joel is the attorney for Drew Peterson. What's the status of that argument, Drew? Joel, sorry.
Oh, right now we're in the middle of drafting our response, our reply briefs, the last set of briefs. And those are basically due Friday, even though I may, because of my cold, I may ask for an extra day or two, which I'm sure I'll get. But we'll be ready to argue that on October 2nd. And the judge will, I don't think he'll rule from the hip, because he knows that either way it's going to go up on appeal. I'm sure he'll want to take time and issue a written opinion. So we'll probably see a decision on it before the end of October. In the meantime, Drew's sitting in the county jail and patiently waiting for the legal wheels to turn.
How is Drew?
Well, I saw him last week. My partner saw him today. He's patient. Drew's a strong man. Doesn't complain. And I'm very fortunate. As a law enforcement officer, he knows the legal process intimately. So he knows what the things take time, and people don't jump just because somebody's locked up, that people will have to sit, for 6, 8, 10 months in order to get the case properly prepared for trial. So, he's doing okay. He's obviously misses his kids, and, obviously wouldn't rather be locked up, but as far as his mental and physical condition is going, he's still doing very well. It's all things being considered.
Last question for you, Joel, and I appreciate you coming on, especially when you're not feeling well. Drew, you and he both said that you tamed him down, so to speak, as far as his personality goes. The Drew Peterson that we saw on television, we heard in the press, even on this program, is not the Drew Peterson that you could have had. A jokester, a prankster, a very gregarious sort of person. Do you think that some of the media that Drew did will eventually hurt him in the long run, or is that not an issue?
I really don't think it's going to be an issue at the trial, and I don't think it hurts him. Obviously, we've not received anything that Drew said and the media is going to be used against him at trial. I think that tells you something. I think also the fact that, I kind of think this, it kind of works in his favor. People have seen, Drew, they hate him because, he doesn't, take the, what's the word I'm looking for? He doesn't project the type of way that they believe he should be projecting. He doesn't act the way people think he should be acting in this circumstance. But having seen that, I think the people are saying, okay, well, that's, you know, he's a little bit different than I am, but I'm still not willing to convict somebody or send somebody off to jail for the rest of their lives simply because they're not acting in a way that I think they should act. I want to see evidence.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to, when push comes to shove and when things really, when a trial starts, if we do get to trial, I think that that's what you're going to see, a jury who wants to see, okay, well, we've heard a lot of noise, we've heard a lot of, you know, rumor and innuendo, and we've heard a lot of goofballs in the way of Len Wozniak and Paula Stark and stuff like that. But now let's put your cards on the table. Show us the hard forensic, the evidence that Drew had anything to do with Kathy's death. Let's see it. And when no evidence like that comes forward, I think we'll have a verdict of not guilty.
Well, it should be interesting. Some say the trial of the century. Joel Brodsky, thank you.
My pleasure. Take care, Dan.
Talk to you, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Attorney Joel Brodsky. will it be the trial of the century? We don't know. It should be interesting to see. I disagree with Joel a little bit, first of all, on hearsay evidence. And, you know, I agree with part of what he said, but not all of it. I believe some hearsay evidence absolutely should be allowed. Look at the McAvoy case, for instance, and it'll be interesting to see how that ruling goes. Will we see a Drew Peterson trial anytime soon? I don't think so. I think there's so many motions on the table that it won't be starting anytime soon, kind of like the Anthony case. That's just my opinion. We're going to take a break here on Scared Monkeys Radio and come back with Pat Brown, criminal profiler, and we're going to get into the J.C. Lee Duggard case. That's that young girl that was kidnapped for 19 years. It's hard to believe still. After a couple of weeks of seeing the story, I think there'll be much more to come. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. You'll know my next guest, Pat Brown, as a criminal profiler, a regular on the Nancy Grace Show and other television programs, and she's always welcome here on this program. Hi, Pat. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Dana.
You know, every time that you and I are talking on my program, there's a strange, bizarre case to talk about. It seems like every day you pick up the newspaper or turn on the TV or listen to the radio, there's another strange, bizarre case. This one turned out with a happy ending, the J.C. Lee Duggard case. I think we've heard very little about the whole story. There's lots more to come out. Even the crazy guy that kidnapped her says that. It should be interesting to see what he has to say. I hope the media doesn't give him too much time, but your thoughts on J.C. Lee Duggard? Hello?
Hello? You're here?
Yeah.
Okay. I think you're talking about a torturous, you know, for the woman now, because she was a child. And now, there's that case for her and for her children and for her mother and for her stepfather and for everybody else in her family. And that's a lot of people to destroy over two decades.
Yeah.
And other crimes and probably those that he's committed over all those years.
Pat, I'm actually losing you. Are you able to get to a different location?
If we can step out of location now? No. Any better?
Yeah, you sound okay. You sound real good for about 10 seconds, and then you cut out. So
10 seconds. Well, there's Verizon and the location I'm in at the moment, so we'll blame it on them. Now I'm standing in the rain because the location I'm in doesn't have a good signal.
Well,
we're here from now on. So, yeah, I think we have a better ending than we could have had, but I think it's pretty much of a shame and a real indictment of our legal system to put a man like this back out in the street after 10 years. When he deserved life in prison without parole. And that's what I think we have to get to the point where if you kidnap a woman or a child or anybody, you kidnap them and you hold them hostage and you rape them, that's life without parole. There is no hope for you. You don't get to come back out and never see the light again.
Yeah, exactly. You talk about three strikes law. It should be one strike for a character like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I mean, it's a big difference that the three strikes are shoplifting, but I mean, by the time you're...
I obviously.
I don't know what you're going to do, be out on the road for again.
Pat, I don't think the "Can you hear me now?" guy is with you because you keep cutting out.
it's unusual because I'm actually outside of a building, so I can't understand how we're having problem with it.
Well, we'll keep going. You're good for it. Again, maybe it's on my side, but Pat Brown, Criminal Profiler, is here. Of course, we're hearing about every 10th word from her, but that's still important when it comes to Pat. Pat, and maybe when we look at this story and we talk about the system and why this guy was out of jail, now let's look at the system and the parole workers or probation workers, the cops, the other people who came into his yard over the years, and they never thought of something. They never saw something going on. It's easy for us to sit back and comment on that, but this is a long time. This poor gal had two babies. Something in the system should have clicked here.
Well, you would think so. I think what happens that people probably aren't looking at, I'm not excusing it because it really upsets me, this whole thing about not going further and digging deeper with a person who is as dangerous as he is. But I think what happens is they don't assume that the crime is going to be committed on the property. They're more concerned about the guy going out and raping and kidnapping in the community, because this man's last, the woman he had victimized, he hadn't brought her home. He had victimized her, put her in a storage unit. So I think sometimes they're not looking at the residents. They're just saying, okay, here's the guy. He's still in town where he is. So that's all we want to do is keep an eye on where he is. We know where he is. And instead of thinking perhaps he's doing something on his own property. But they certainly have people calling in. So to me, they should have a methodology. First of all, if you have to watch a guy this closely, he shouldn't be out of prison. I mean, that's a simple fact. If you don't trust him, in other words, if you're going to let the guy out after 10 years, you should be willing to send him home and to stay with your sister for the week.
Yeah.
If you're not willing to do that, basically you shouldn't have to watch the guy. So if you're going to let him out, he has to be the type of guy that you believe is safe in society, period. Not, we'll check up on you once every 2 weeks, drop by your house, ring your doorbell, but 24 hours a day, we're going to leave you out in society and hope that you just don't grab a kid and rape and kill it before we get back 2 weeks later. To me, that's just ludicrous. So if you've committed a heinous crime, you just don't come out. But so somebody you let out, you shouldn't even have to check up on them in that sense. But if you do it, then you got to be all over them.
Yes.
And they should have been in every nook and cranny of that guy's life if they were going to let him out.
Yeah, they knew about him. It's just, I don't know if it's a lack of manpower, if it's a lack of interest, if it's laziness, if it's, you know, a whole bunch of combination of things.
Yeah, I think a lot of times they have so many cases, they're so overwhelmed. When we look at how many sex predators are in the community, after a while they just become like, they're just so regular. They're regular guys, in a sense, to parole workers. I mean, they're out there looking around. It's like, yeah, here's Bob. Yeah, he exposed himself. Oh, yeah, here's John. Yeah, he raped his mate. Oh, yeah, here's... And they're so used to it. They're so used to talking with these guys. They almost get on a friendly basis. But I think they almost forget how dangerous they are. That they're psychopaths. Now, you know, if they're at a high level of sex offense, they're psychopaths, and they will say anything to you. They'll lie to you, they'll charm you, or do anything they can to get around you, finding out what they're doing. But I think a lot of the workers go out there and they just get used to it. They get, you know, kind of complacent about the whole thing. And that's my point, is that if they have to watch the guys, they shouldn't be out of prison.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the girl a bit. Last week, when I covered this story, we were talking about Stockholm Syndrome and kidnap victims. You know, look at Patty Hearst and all that. What's your thoughts on Stockholm and this girl?
Well, I think people have to give her a little bit of a break, in the sense that they have to understand that her life wasn't awful 24 hours a day. I think that's going to be the biggest mistake people are going to make with her. You know, after you've been kidnapped, and yes, you've been raped, and horrible things have happened, but if you look around the world, many girls are forced into marriages at 11, 12, 13 mm-hmm. years of age. And in a sense, they're kidnapped and raped as well, except that in that society, it's considered acceptable, and perhaps the parents went along with it. But that little girl at 11 years old did not want to go marry that 30-year-old man.
Yep.
And she's pregnant by the time she's 13 or 14. Great many societies in the world. That doesn't invalidate her entire life. Even though it's an unfortunate, horrible situation, and she did not have a choice in it, it doesn't mean that every one of her days was miserable, that she never had any joy, that she never laughed, that she never had value to her life. So in spite of the fact this girl, you know, JC, was kidnapped and was raped and had no choices and was trapped in that location, she had the joy of her babies. She had the joy of having family to some extent, how bizarre though it was. The girls, apparently, they did read, they did... do, you know, they learn things, and I was a homeschooler. I homeschooled all three of my children, and they did get past the backyard, you know. They did get further than that. They had lots of friends and were involved in sports and things like that, but I did homeschool my children all the way through, and for many days we get up in the morning and we do our math lessons and then we read some literature and then we put on a play and then we did all kinds of fun things in the house. And I'm guessing that some of JC's days and her daughter's days were like this, in spite of the creature that had them in captivity and the creature's life. I mean, in spite of that, they had some things that they did that were good. And I think that the family has to let them know that they know that they had some good in their lives, so they don't feel like their whole lives were a waste. And then help them with all the other trauma, bringing them into society and helping them understand what they've gone through, but not invalidate their lives entirely.
Pat Brown, Criminal Profilers here. Last question, Pat. When the time comes, and he's already given a little bit of media, the kidnapper himself will be looking for it. I think the cable news shows will be all over it. Hell, I'd bring him on this show to talk to him. Is that right or wrong?
Well, it depends how we talk to him, I suppose. What I don't like is to give him the time of day in the sense that we're buying his garbage.
Yeah.
Like when he starts with the "I have a sex addiction" crap, which a lot of psychologists are buying and a lot of defense lawyers are pushing. No, you didn't have a sex addiction. That's ludicrous. You chose to kidnap and rape young girls, and that's not a sex addiction. That's an excuse. There's no such thing as sex addiction. Just because you like to have sex doesn't mean you get to torture people with it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got his new little CD now with his music on it. Oh, how lovely. We get to hear you sing lovely songs about little children. I think it's disturbed if we allow him the benefit of giving him credibility, as opposed to teaching people that this is how psychopaths work, this is how deranged they are, and this is why society has to fight against them and put these guys away forever. If it serves a real educational purpose, I don't have a problem with it. But if we're just going to buy into their junk and let them be celebrities and let them make excuses, then I have a problem with it.
I agree totally. Pat Brown, you're always welcome here. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks, Dana.
Talk to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's Pat Brown, Criminal Profiler. Yeah, I really hope they don't give much media to the guy. But if they do bring him on, let's get the real story from him, not like a John Mark Carr. My name's Dana Pretzer. I got an interesting guest coming up next. It's going to be actually a big kick to have the Gateway Pundit. You'll know him as a political blogger. He's going to be one of the speakers at the September 12th Quincy Tea Party, where many grassroots bloggers will be talking. Go to quincyteaparty.com, and we're going to have Jim Hoft, who is the Gateway Pundit, coming on the show here in just a minute after we take a quick break here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. If we had a scorecard for mainstream media versus the bloggers, in this case it would be bloggers 1, mainstream media minus 2. We all know this is a green job czar. You know, just hearing that name kind of gives you the creeps. Van Jones, who has since quit, the goof that he was. We never heard much of that about on the mainstream media. A little bit on Fox News. In fact, Fox News finally give credit to one of the guys who was behind getting the story out about this goof. His name is Jim Hoft. We know him as the Gateway Pundit. He will be at the Quincy Tea Party on September 12th. There's a website, quincyteaparty.com, and the Gateway Pundit's blog site is gatewaypundit.blogspot.com. It's a big kick for me to have the Gateway Pundit, Jim Hoft, on the program tonight. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Dana. How you doing?
I'm great. I love working with the blogs. I've been doing this program 12 years now, the last three, with Red and the fine folks over at Scared Monkeys, the bloggers, the guys who get the story right, like Jack Webb used to say on Dragnet, just the facts. And we get them,
right.
And we have no, you know, this no-spin stuff that you hear O'Reilly talk about. That's the bloggers. That's not so much Fox News, although they do a pretty good job. Tell us about your blog. Tell us why you're the Gateway Pundit.
All right. Well, I've been blogging here. I'm located in St. Louis, and I'm in St. Louis, of course, is a gateway to the West. And I started a blog back in late 2004, early 2005, and have had quite a success, really. Enjoyed doing the blogging. It's grown from just a couple readers a day to I'm averaging over maybe 50,000-60,000 people a day today. So it's been a fun road, and it's been great to report on some of those stories that obviously the media is not going to touch, like the Van Jones story from today.
Yeah. And when you see that, And I see the work that you've done. I have followed your site, and of course the fine work here at Scared Monkeys. And with the technology today, Jim, compared to, you know, even 10 years ago or even when I started this program, you had the choice of turning on television. The cable news shows were just starting at that time, but you had the mainstream networks. And I brought up the term long ago, what I called my show Main Street Media rather than mainstream media, because you brought the average Joes on, you talked about, you know, Joe and Mary six-pack stories, and you wanted to report on what the people really wanted to hear. And I think with the Internet, and as big as it is right now, the people are looking for other sources, or am I wrong?
Oh, I think you're right. I think a lot of people are turning to the Internet to find the news, and really the reason is because the mainstream media just refuses to report on a lot of stories. And so I think it's really, if you want to get the full story, that's what you need to do today. You have to do the extra work, unfortunately, to find the truth out in our society today.
Why is it that the mainstream media aren't touching some of these stories? You know, you can go left wing, right wing, wing nut if you wanted to, all that kind of stuff. But some, you know, NBC especially, they've gone right down in the crapper. And MSNBC is unbelievable. Why is it gone to that?
Well, I think, you know, what we saw, obviously, during the election last year, we've never seen the media support a candidate as much as they did Barack Obama, and we've never seen a media protect a candidate like they did Barack Obama. In fact, that's why this Van Jones story is so critical today. What we saw this past week was, instead of the media reporting and protecting the public from the administration, what they did this week was they protected the administration from the public. Mm-hmm. They refused to report on this radical who's been in the White House that some other people had to, you know, besides myself, had discovered some just unbelievable, you know, facts, videos, and stories about this man. And the mainstream media refused to report it. In fact, Dana, tomorrow for the first time, the New York Times is going to have a print article about this Van Jones scandal, okay? By the time they put it in print, the story of his resignation will already be 36 hours old. So the readers of the New York Times, the paper of record, tomorrow morning are going to pick it up, read this article that Van Jones has resigned, and not have any information on it until tomorrow morning.
Right.
Right? Yeah. It's really unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
What is going on in our society today.
It is unbelievable, and most will pick it up, read it, and say who, and go on to the next story because they don't know all the facts.
And they still won't tomorrow, unfortunately, because even today, with his resignation, the mainstream media touched a couple things that he said. They, you know, they touched the fact that he said, you know, that Republicans are a-holes. But, you know, that just makes it sound like Republicans are so sensitive.
Right.
They didn't touch half of the things that he has said. I mean, really some outrageous things. That, you know, he's a confirmed communist. He has supported this cop killer, Mumia Abu-Jamal. They actually released a album together, which is just amazing. And this guy's in the White House, and he was going to be in control of like $60 billion for the green energy program. It's incredible.
You know,
it's an incredible story.
A buddy of Obama's, and with this story, and it was great to see you get some credit by Crystal on Fox News. But you have to wonder. You have to wonder how many others are in that White House. How many others have positions of power, either low, high, or medium level, that are nuts? You know, we heard about Jeremiah Wright, and even that was whitewashed by the mainstream media.
Oh, yeah.
And that's died down now, except when he gets on TMZ or someplace like that and starts yapping again.
Uh-huh.
But the people, are they just blinded do they really care? You know, you see the tea parties, and you're going to be part of that. I want you to talk about that in a little bit. But when you see these stories, there's a lot out there. You know, the town halls for health care, all this other stuff that's going on right now. The Democrats that think they had such a stranglehold with their Messiah Obama are finding out now that they've got kind of Barney Fife as president, and it's starting to backfire on them.
And it should. What they not only have an inexperienced president, but they have a far left radical who's a president. We've never seen anything like it. You know, we've never seen a leader like this in the United States. We've never seen a leader who would support Castro and Chavez and Evo Morales, the Marxist dictators of this hemisphere, and side against the Honduran government, a democratically elected government. That's what we have today. And if most people knew about this, they'd be outraged. But our media hides a lot of this from the American public. And it's just, like I said, a shocking situation what's going on in America today.
Jim Hoff, the great Gateway Pundit, is here. You can go to his blog site by going to gatewaypundit.blogspot.com. Tell us about the Tea Parties. Again, that's something that, you know, unless you're a follower of the news and interested, you'll hear about them and say, the what? What's this all about?
The Tea Party in Quincy is going to be this weekend coming up. In Quincy, Illinois, and they're expecting thousands of people there. I'm going to be one of the speakers at the event. I talked to your friend Red, and he said he may venture up there to Quincy, Illinois.
Wow.
So they're expecting thousands of people. What it is of course, the Tea Party movement started back in earlier this year when the Congress was pushing this mammoth spending bill on the country, that $787 billion, stimulus that they said they needed to push through right away because it would create jobs and it would save our economy from an unemployment rate of higher than 8%. What we see today, what that got us, the unemployment rate is 9.7%. The country is $1 trillion more in debt, and it did nothing. It did absolutely nothing to stimulate the economy, and mostly because the bill was set up to where it was just going to benefit all the supporters of the Democratic Party, all of those different factions that helped elect Obama. That's what it was set up as. And so, of course, it's not going to stimulate the economy. Like 1% or less went to small businesses, the engine of our economy.
Yeah.
So, what could they expect? They knew it wasn't going to work. We knew it wasn't going to work, and so people went to the streets back in April and were outraged, normal Americans, and it's been building throughout the summer. We saw it at the town hall events. I had people come up to me at a couple of the events here in town and tell me they had never seen people protest an active president 6 months into his administration. They've never seen anything like it. And that's what we're seeing today because this administration is so radical. And this Congress is so radical. And they're so different than what they told the American public they'd be. And they're ramming all this legislation down our throats. Now they want to take over 1/6 of the economy with the health care bill. And Americans are fed up. So I expect that there's going to be thousands in Quincy next weekend. And thousands in Washington, D.C.
And as a blogger, and I really appreciate you coming on, Jim, when you try to get the story out, you know, whether it's to 5 people or 50 or 60,000, like you say, you want to get out the facts, the trueness. But you also have to have something to attract the people to read or to come to your site to be interested in the story. And I've always asked or always wondered how Red is able to do it with Scared Monkeys and others are able to do it. How do you get the people's attention?
You're right. Well, I think a lot of it has been that you have to build a name and a name based on trust. People have to trust your content because it's not going to do them any good if if you're lying to them.
Right.
It's not going to do you any good. So you have to have that trust, and you have to have some interesting stories. And for myself, my interest from the beginning was to correct what the media was feeding the American people. And I that's still my passion, is to, you know, bring the stories to the public that, that our mainstream media is not reporting on. And, of course, again, the best example of that this past week is a Van Jones story.
Yeah.
None of the media has touched half of the Van Jones story. And here they are. Now they're scurrying to try to find out information on him that he's resigned. You know, and the blogs are just way ahead of them, and I'm glad that I was part of that.
Well, you've done a great job. Again, the website is gatewaypundit.blogspot.com. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Have you on again sometime.
Right. Bye-bye.
That's Jim Hoff. We call him the Gateway Pundit, and check out his blog. It's interesting for sure. Again, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, something that you won't see in the mainstream media. That's it. That's tonight's show. My name's Dana Pretzer. Check out the webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com, or if you're interested in another fine blog, go to scaredmonkeys.com. We'll see you again next week here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.